Today's Taisho is on Case 31 in the Mumonkan. Joshu investigates an old woman. A monk asked an old woman, "What is the way to Taisan?" The old woman said, "Go straight ahead." When the monk had proceeded a few steps, she said, "A good, respectable monk, but he too goes that way." Afterward, someone told Joshu about this. Joshu said, "Wait a bit, I will go and investigate the old woman for you." The next day, he went and asked the same question, and the old woman gave the same answer. On returning, Joshu said to his disciples, "I have investigated the old woman of Taishan for you." Mumon's comment: the old woman only knew how to sit still in her tent and plan her campaign. She did not know when she was shadowed by a spy. Though old Joshu showed himself clever enough to take a camp and overwhelm a fortress, he displayed no trace of being a great commander. If we look at them, they both have their faults. But tell me, what did Joshu see in the old woman? Mumon's verse: the question was like the others. The answer was the same. Sand in the rice, thorns in the mud. Well, today is the third day of our October Sesshin, and this was a smaller group this morning, but everybody was sitting beautifully, and it was a pure pleasure to do Dokusan last night. We all know each other, and many of us have practiced together for a long time. So it's really just a pure pleasure. It's wonderful. And there's a process, of course. People get interested in Zen. We have our beginning classes at the university. And maybe in the course of I have a really cool advertisement that I put in the Targum. And it's beautiful. It's 8th century calligraphy. I'm sorry, it's 12th century Chinese calligraphy. And it's Zhou Chan. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, but Zazen. And it's beautiful. And it's actually almost magical. Because when I put it in the Targum, I get quite a response, you know. When school starts and that ad goes into the paper, first of all, we give away pamphlets at the activities fair, and I think that we probably give away hundreds of pamphlets, and I think that brings the first wave into the Zendo, and then the ad brings the second wave. So on a particular Friday night early on, we've had as many as 40 people. We've had like standing room or sitting room only. The place has been packed. This has happened a number of times. And this year hasn't been quite as spectacular as some years, but some years it's like up until midterms, we get a big, you know, a capacity crowd every Friday night. So all of these people come. With some curiosity, you know, and that's wonderful. They want to know something about Zen. Most of them have never heard of Zen, actually. So they see the thing for meditation, or they look at the handbills that we give out, and they come to give it a try. And a lot of them come just once, you know. And a number of them come couple times, and some of them, eventually there's a huge attrition rate, you know, where lots of people come the first time, fewer people come a second time, fewer people come a third time, and then finally there's a good crowd, but it's a modest group, right? It's maybe, I don't know, 10%, something like that. And then people get into Zen practice maybe a little more seriously. They start sitting. Some people come for a semester, and then they disappear. I saw somebody the other day who was coming last year quite often, at least once a week. And over the summer, she sort of just sort of like petered out. Right? She started coming less, and then so I was going to my office the other day, and I saw her on the quad in front of Murray Hall, and she looked very embarrassed, you know, like I was going to yell at her for not coming to sit. She said, "Oh, I'm coming back," and I said, "Please understand that if you don't want to practice, it's okay with me. You know, I don't hold it against you. That would be like, teaching oil painting, and somebody doesn't come back and take the next lesson, and you get mad at them. You know." So I said, "I assure you, that's not how I feel at all." You know, and she's an artist, so I used the oil painting metaphor, but she thought I might be mad at her or something. Like that. So anyway, there's this attrition, and then you know some people come to sesshin even. They get as far as sesshin, and they decide this is just not for me, you know. And maybe they do one sesshin. People come and just do one sesshin. People come and just do like 3 days of a sesshin, and they jump in their car and drive away. You know, that's happened. As if you've been practicing for a while, you know that happens, right? It's usually like day three, right? And you can hear the gravel, the tires, you know, shooting the gravel into the air, you know, stream by the zendo. You know. Some people stay, I'm happy to say, and those people, find that there's something about this practice that really speaks to them. Something about this practice really speaks to them. I don't think there's any one right way to live. I really don't. But I think that for some people, this makes just a whole lot of sense, right? It might not make intellectual sense, but there's something about it that's very energizing, and it makes you feel more alive and more free. My feeling is that it has something to do the method of Zen, you know. Let me read you the koan again. Go through the koan again. A monk asked an old woman, "What is the way to..." In the Japanese version, it's Taishan, but it's really Taishan. It's Taishan. It's one of the Buddhist mountains of China. And at one time, there are these Buddhist mountains in China. There's Emeshan, Taishan, and several others. And at one time, before the Cultural Revolution in China, Taishan had quite a few nunneries, monasteries, and places for Tibetan lamas. There were maybe 25 different kinds of temples up there. And people would do pilgrimages. Xu Yun, in the 20th century, did pilgrimages to all the sacred mountains of Buddhist tradition in China. And he actually walked all over China and would go and stay at temples on the five, I believe it's five, maybe it's four, mountains in China. And so this is like a pilgrimage site, and monks and nuns go there, and this is, now this is happening again in China. They're sprucing up the temples, they're letting people practice, they're sprucing up the temples, and people are going on these pilgrimages. So there are some disciples of Joshu who are going on a pilgrimage, and it turns out that on the way up the mountain, as you go up the mountain, there was, there are all these temples up on the mountain, these 20-some temples. And there are stairs or paths going up the mountains. But at the foot of the mountain, there's a tea stall, a woman sells tea, an old woman sells tea down there. These monks have gone to go up the mountain, and they think this is going to be very like a holy activity, right? Going on a pilgrimage is, what they think of as an act of, you could just say religious act, right? So anyway, they going on the pilgrimage, they get to Taishan, and they can't find their way. They don't know how to get up the mountain. They've lost the path. And basically they go into the tea house, the tea stall, and they ask this old woman, she's a person of no importance, right? She's not a great lama or a great Zen teacher. She's not in one of the big temples up on the hill. She's eking out a living at the foot of Taishan, selling tea. So an old monk, a monk asked an old woman, "What's the way to Taishan?" And now, what you would expect her to say is, go up by those rocks and take a left, or go north, or look for the, and he says, "What's the way to Taishan?" And instead what she says is, "Go straight ahead." So the monk must have been facing in one direction, and so he starts walking, but he takes a few steps and he realizes, well, straight ahead, you're not telling me where to go, right? You're not telling me where to go. He says, "What's the way to Taishan?" "Go straight ahead." He starts walking straight ahead, and then he goes, "Wait a minute, that's not a direction, right? North, east, south, and west, that's a direction." And as he's walking, starting to walk, she says, here comes another one of these monks who's going like in the wrong direction, she seems to be saying. So anyway, this monk, maybe it's a couple monks, they go back to Joshu, who's their teacher, and they tell Joshu about this mean old woman, right? And they come back and they say, "Joshu, this mean woman humiliated us, we're monks, and she didn't treat us with respect, and so on and so on, and she wouldn't tell us the way to Taishan, so we couldn't get to Taishan." So Joshu said, "Wait a bit, I will go and investigate the old woman for you." See? And the next day he went and asked the same question. See, he goes to the old woman and he says, "How do I get to Taishan?" And the old woman gave the same answer. "Go straight ahead." Now, we don't know what happened next, right? We don't get that part of the story. On returning, Joshu said to his disciples, "I have investigated the old woman of Taishan for you." So that's the story, that's the koan. It's wonderful to come here and practice Zen, I think. I don't know about you, but when I got up this morning, I had a beautiful sit. My mind was clear and bright, and my heart has been purified, you know. It's my heart has been purified by our days of practice, and I feel really wonderful, just really great. And this is sort of like what we expect Zen practice to be. You know, you come to the sesshin, and you sit on the cushion, and you're supposed to have like a peace and serenity. And I'm telling you, that's part of the package. But one of the interesting things that can happen when you're practicing is that you don't get peace and serenity. You know, you just don't get it. Somebody came in to Dokusan and said something like this. He said, you know, I've been practicing for so many years, and I keep finding obstacles. I keep finding the same old bullshit over and over again, you know. I encounter the same old bullshit. And I've been sitting for so many years, you know, it's so remarkable that I keep encountering this bullshit, you know. And I think the person was saying, I want to, I want to have peace and serenity, not the bullshit, you know. Somebody else came in and was talking about how hard it was to sit because all of these obstacles were coming up, you know, all of these obstacles were arising. And this person was having actual physical discomfort. You know, some people have, really like a real, I don't just mean pain in the legs, but some people have like acute, you know, like nausea, migraine type headaches, all of these kinds of physical problems when sitting. And if you don't have this, you're very lucky, you know. Some people have other kinds of problems too, you know. They sit on the cushion and start doing a meditation around day three or around day two, maybe, you know. They just go through this process of just outraged, you know, outraged. And all of these things happen, you know, at sesshin. And it's not necessarily what we signed up for. Yet, you know, it's so important. It's so important. I mean, I know that some people encounter these barriers in themselves, and they feel that the meditation hasn't worked. You know, they say, well, I've been sitting for X number of years, and there's still this anger in me, or there's still this fear. Or maybe you've come to a number of sesshins, and, you know, you undergo the tortures of the damned. You know, you nausea, dizziness, people get, as I said, these headaches, you know, this, well, it works, you know, and it, you might think, well, this is just not working, you know, but think again about that, because, there's something Well, there's a way of practicing which is dedicated to serenity, you know, just being serene, being still and peaceful. That's one way to practice, you know, with the goal of serenity, stillness. And you could think of sesshin as like an escape from the madness of life. And indeed, our culture is truly insane, you know. So it is true that when you come here, you are getting away from like an unhealthy world, and you are living, I think, a more healthy life. And so, you know, we come to sesshin and we want to have an experience of like a peace and bliss and a stillness and serenity. You know, there's a wonderful poem. There's a wonderful collection of poems called the Cold Mountain Poems. And our lineage is actually named after the person Hanshan, who was the poet who wrote these poems. And they're really just beautiful. Hanshan was probably like a government bureaucrat in China. And he just decided he'd had enough of the bullshit of his society. And became a solitary monk up in the mountains. And he lived in a cave, right? He lived in a cave and, you know, had no central heating and none of that stuff, you know, ate whatever people offered, and he probably ate things like, wild plants and things like that. And he wrote these poems on like scraps of paper or pieces of bark, you know. And they were collected after his death, and they're very famous poems. And, Hanshan is really admired in the Zen world, and he's also really admired in Chinese culture. So he's not like a highbrow poet. He's like a Jack Kerouac figure, from what I understand, in Chinese culture. In other words, he's a very refined people think he's kind of an idiot, you know. But lots of ordinary people, and especially Zen people over the centuries, have really loved his poetry. And I just wanted to read you a little piece of it. Towering cliffs were the home I chose, bird trails beyond human tracks. What does my yard contain? White clouds clinging to dark rocks. Every year I've lived here, I've seen the seasons change. All you owners of tripods and bells, what good are empty names? All you who read my poems, guard your purity of heart. Let your greed be modesty, your flattery be honesty. Put an end to evil karma. Trust your true nature. Find your Buddha body today. Do it as fast as an order, as following an order. The cold mountain road is strange. No tracks of cart or horse. It's hard to recall which merging stream or tell which piled up ridge. A myriad plants are dripping with dew. The pines all sigh the same. Here where the trail disappears, form asks shadow where to go. Looking for a refuge, cold mountain will keep you safe. A faint wind stirs dark pines. Come closer to the sound, and it gets better. Below them sits a gray-haired old man chanting Taoist texts. 10 years lost and unable to return, he forgot the way he came. My mind is like the autumn moon, clear and bright in a pool of jade. Nothing can compare to that mind. What more can I say? The mountains are so cold, not just now but every year. Crowded ridges breathe in snow. sunless forest breathe out mist. Nothing grows until leaves fall before autumn begins. A lost traveler here looks in vain for the sky. Yeah, I guess because there's so many trees. It's a little hard to follow, but it's really a beautiful life up in the mountains of complete simplicity and stillness. And this has inspired generations of Zen practitioners. You know, even into the 20th century, people go up into the mountains and of China and live as solitary hermits. And they live off of nothing, really. It's really a remarkable life. And it's a very serene, peaceful life, right? You go up into the mountains, up into the forests, and just become one with nature. You know, that's a beautiful way to live. Beautiful. And, you know, if that's your way, if that's your path, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, some people feel really called by their true nature to live that way, you know. You just want to cut off all distractions, simplify, purify your life, and live in a remote place. And that's just wonderful, right? And that would be wonderful. Yeah. Or would it? See, I mean, if it's your way, that's great. If that's what you want to do, go for it. But it's going to be a little hard to do in the United States, I think. You know what I mean? Because let's say you decide you're going to live this way, and you put on a backpack, and you go up into the mountains you go on the Appalachian Trail, and you live in a cave. Maybe there's a cave that isn't occupied by a bear or something. Okay. And you live there. And then one day you live there until your shoes fall off and your clothes are in rags, right? And one day you're walking around looking for food and a park ranger sees you and tries to arrest you. And then you run away. Right? And you run away from the parkland, and then you find another place that's near the park, but it's not in the parkland. And you find another cave, and there's no bear in there, right? And then you're sitting there peacefully boiling your water, and you're going to put some acorns in there, and have some acorns for breakfast, you know? And then you start hearing trees crashing, and a terrible noise. And here comes the bulldozers, right? And they're going to put in Witherspoon Acres, right? And it's going to be gigantic 20-room houses, mansions, as far as the eye can see. Yeah. And you can say, oh, damn it, you know, my paradise has been ruined. You know? This is a constant temptation, right? Because there is something. The goal of wanting to be serene and still and peaceful is not a bad goal. It's the highest consciousness is still and peaceful and serene and on imperturbable. The deepest enlightenment is like that. It's like a ocean, in a still ocean, extending infinitely in all directions. You know, really and truly, enlightened mind is like this. It's like a pure sky with no clouds, you know, the big radish. You know, it's very important to realize that you have to get there. I hope I'm making sense, but you can't get there except by getting lost. You know, you have to get lost. This is very important. See, I mean, let me just say again, if your true nature says, I go up and live in the mountains, you know, if you want to be a monk or a nun, I actually have nothing but respect for people who do that. And in fact, if people don't become monks and nuns, I figure that Buddhism will disappear, because they really have been the core of this practice. You know, there's a very famous Roshi named Suzuki Roshi. He wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And Suzuki Roshi said, when you start practicing, the hard part is getting onto the cushion and getting tearing yourself away from worldly affairs and getting onto the cushion. And he said, but when you've been practicing a long time, the hard part is getting off the cushion and getting out into worldly affairs. Now, I actually don't agree. You know, I actually don't agree with him. I think basically that telling Americans that is like it's like you're giving crack to a crack addict. You know, so you're saying don't sit too much. You know? And you do see these Zen groups where at least 50% of the time is spent in like social activism. So the Zen group is really like a social activist group. And if that's what you want to do, good. But it's very, very important for people to do a lot of Zazen. There's probably no American who has done too much Zazen. You know, that's not a danger for Buddhists in America, right? So lots of Zazen is very important, very important. But on the other hand, if it's not your true nature to live on a mountaintop and eat acorn soup for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and if it is, that's okay. But if it's not your true nature, having entanglements in the world is a very, very beneficial thing. And it's very, very beneficial. Because one way to think about enlightenment is this. I am unhappy and angry and the world's a crummy place, etc., etc. And then I do lots of Zazen and I purify my body, mind, and heart, and I have Daikensho and I'm liberated. See, that's one way to think about Zen practice. And so, if that's true, we could all go up on the mountain. You know, we could say, let's get out of here. This is a crazy world. Why are we wasting our time on this stupid society? And we could go up and live in a mountain and get up every day and say, like Han Shan, even though I love Han Shan, we could get up and walk around in the woods and look at the mountains. And by the way, there's almost nothing. I'm not criticizing doing that. That's part of there's nothing I'd rather do, right? So please understand what I'm saying. He says, my mind is like the autumn moon, clear and bright in a pool of jade. Nothing can compare. What more can I say? So I'm in nature, everything's at peace, my mind is enlightened, it's clear and bright like the moon, reflected in a jade pool. Perfect, right? The truth is that that's actually probably not the highest form of awareness, see? Because it's still caught up in a kind of separateness from other things, you decide to emulate Han Shan, and you go live in the Appalachian Trail Park, and you get run off by the ranger, and then you sit down and you find another cave, and here comes the developers. And you know, you think, God damn those developers, you know. They're destroying my beautiful world, you know. I hate them. And at that moment, you know, your enlightenment is your enlightenment is very limited, very small. You know, it's not taking in everything. that there is in this moment, right? See, I mean, it's okay if I'm on a mountaintop and I'm listening to the wind and the breezes and the acorns are cooking, you know, wonderful. But that's my moment, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if the bulldozer had come, that's also my moment. I'm probably not making any sense this morning, but what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the world is a crazy place in a million different ways, and it just gets, actually just gets crazier every day. And it's possible to say, oh, woe is me, if only I lived in the Tang Dynasty when everybody respected Zazen. But this craziness can be a wonderful opportunity to experience enlightened mind. You know, when you are in your job and it's a crazy world, and you know, you have 10,000 things to do, and you're pulled in this direction and that, and you come to Sashin, all of a sudden your mind is just like so caught up in all of this stuff, right? It's like, my God, you know, what a madhouse my mind has become. And then we sit on the cushion and we watch the breath, or we call Mu. And after a couple of days, the mind begins to become very calm, very, very serene. And that's wonderful. But those, I think the time we spent clarifying all of that junk, purifying all of that junk, is not like waste. It's not like time wasted. It gives us deeper practice, because we have to include all of these things that are crazy and are distracting. And in other words, you know, real enlightenment isn't my personal enlightenment. It has to include everything in the world. It has to include everything in my world, you know, everything that comes my way, is another way of putting it. See? So it could be an obstacle from outside myself, you know, like losing my job or something like that, not getting something you really want. Or could be an obstacle in yourself. You know, you come to Sashin and you think, okay, maybe this is the Sashin I'm going to have a great awakening experience. And then what do you know? Nausea and headaches, right? And you think, this is crap. You know, where's my beautiful, serene mountaintop? But honestly, you know, if you're having a headache, it's your world. You know, if you have nausea when you sit, that's part of your world. You can get in a car and drive away. But whatever is causing those obstacles is still there in your mind, body, and heart. So running away from Sashin doesn't solve the problem. You have to work through the obstacles. And you can, and of course, you might say, some obstacles I didn't create, right? Look at our society. It's a crazy society, you know. All the same, you did create them, you know. Actually, not your personal self, but your bigger self created the whole mess, you know. So it's like when we sit on the cushion, we're not just purifying our own body, mind, and heart. We have to purify everything, you know. I mean, that might sound crazy, but it's absolutely true. You know, if you turn on the TV sometimes, you see terrible things, you know. Every once in a while, I'll turn on the TV and I'll see something so disturbing. I'll just think, my God, I wish this hadn't gotten into my mind. In my wildest imaginings, I never would have imagined such a thing. There was a movie a long time ago called Marathon Man. I remember it involved it was a ridiculous movie, you know. It was about part of it was that there was a Nazi who had hidden out in New York and become a dentist. And he, I know, incredible. And he had killed, what's his name, Roy Scheider, is that his name? He had killed Roy Scheider, who was a spy. And Roy Scheider's younger brother, Dustin Hoffman, was trying to find out who had killed his brother. And so he begins to suspect that it's the dentist who is really a Nazi, okay? In order to get close to the dentist, at one point, he has to go in for dental work. See, Hollywood, incredible, right? He has to go in for dental work. The question is, does the Nazi dentist know I know? See? So anyway, the Nazi dentist straps him into the chair, right? You know? And then Dustin Hoffman gets a little nervous because now he's taken this Novocaine and he can't move or something. And now the Nazi doctor is supposed to fix his tooth, but he starts pulling all his teeth out, right? Trying to get to the truth. I mean, it's so crazy, right? So, it's just Hollywood, right? It's like the illusion factory, you know? So let's say you turn on the TV and there's an old rerun of a Marathon Man, and there's a guy pulling all the teeth out of Dustin Hoffman, right? And then you come to Sashin and, you know, your legs hurt and you keep thinking about this dentist pulling the teeth out of him. So you think, why did I ever put that in my mind? You know, I wish I hadn't. But, you know, and you can say, well, that wasn't my thought. You know, but it's one world. You know, it's one world. All the ideas everybody's coming up with are your ideas. All the crazy behaviors are your behaviors. And you might say, well, no, they're not. You know, I don't have a gigantic gas-guzzling, SUV or something like that. I'm not creating global warming, but we all have to deal with it, right? And if actually the self is really the boundaries of myself go on and on. You know, everybody is myself. Everything that happens is my true nature. So when I sit on the cushion, you know, I may not have stillness. I may not have peace. I may have to encounter a lot of difficult obstacles. And some of those may be created by my life, and some of those may have been thrust upon me by circumstances. You know, but it's very important to encounter these obstacles in ourselves. The old woman is a deeply awakened being. But in this koan, she represents what the monks don't want to face in themselves. See, I mean, these monks are living on a mountaintop, and they're used to being treated with respect, etc. And they're trying to go to the sacred mountain, to the holy place, to enlightenment. And they get lost. And they ask the old woman for advice, and she actually gives them good advice, but they can't hear it. See, because they don't respect her, or they don't know how to listen to her. But what she's telling them is, you have to go straight ahead. There's no escaping going through your obstacles. See, and that's true at Sashin, and it's true out of Sashin. See, I mean, I hope I'm making some sense now. Probably not, you know. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the obstacles are very, very important in Zen practice. They're the path to enlightenment. If we just came in, if we could come into a Sashin and just bliss out, see, this would be like a drug. But the world is full of obstacles in ourselves, and full of confusion and all kinds of destructive energies. And when we sit on the cushion, we encounter those in ourselves, and when we are living our lives, we encounter them in the world, and so they become part of ourselves. And when we come to Sashin, we have to work through those barriers. And if you can't answer your koan, it's because there's something in you maybe, that you're not ready to confront. You know, there's something that you don't want to face, or there's something that you're afraid of. And I'm not criticizing you. I'm not saying you're a coward, you know, or something like that. No matter how long you practice, there's still barriers. There's still things that bother you, that frighten you, that make you close up. So each time you come to Zen practice, each time you come to like a sesshin, you encounter these barriers in yourself. You didn't even know they exist. You know, the whole point of koans is to help you find these barriers in yourself. And then you begin to work through them. And then when you work through them, you know, then when you work through them, then my mind is like the autumn moon, clear and bright in a pool of jade. Nothing can compare. What more can I say? See, that's it. But the road to the mountaintop means that you have to get lost a little bit. And so don't, you know, this is day 3 of sesshin. Please don't get discouraged if you're encountering obstacles. You know, that's absolutely, when people come in and they tell me about their obstacles, maybe you're crying inside, but I'm thinking how wonderful. See, this is how Buddhas are made. This is how the Bodhisattvas come into being, by encountering our obstacles and working them through. So there's really no problem, you know, really and truly. Just go straight ahead, right? Just like the woman said. Just watch your breath, call Mu, work with your koan. Don't give a moment's thought to anything except that, you know? And it may take a million years to answer your koan, and it may take 10 minutes. But please don't be mistaken about the obstacle is the path. You know, that sounds so trite, but there's no other way to wake up except to encounter our obstacles. So I'm sure you have a few. I still do, and I'm working on it. So we're here together on this beautiful day. This beautiful summer day. Really strange. But how wonderful to practice together. So let's face our obstacles and go through them. Okay.